silly season. What silly season? There's tons to discuss on this week's Media Talk, starting with the big news at Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. He's announced he will start charging for all his online news content by next summer. But where Murdoch leads, will the rest of the media industry follow? Plus, what is going on with The Observer?
If the chief executive issues a statement in which he fails to deny that The Observer is for sale, then it does give rise to speculation and is the reason that the headlines have occurred this week.
Roy Greenslade gives his view on the future of the world's oldest Sunday paper. Also in the podcast,
amid this haze of drugs, sex and rock and roll, Amy Winehouse has just been released on bail.
From More 4 News to No More News, Channel 4 looks to save costs by cutting back on its news output. Plus, Mihir Bose resigns from the BBC. Was the corporation's former sports editor ever cut out for a broadcasting career? I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk from The Guardian. In the week, The Times brought us news about the sad death of Benson, Britain's biggest carp. We have two very big fish here in the pod. James Robinson is the Observer's media editor. Are you handy with a rod and tackle, James?
Am I handy with a rod and tackle? What sort of question is that?
I mean, start with some really inappropriate innuendo.
Also in the pod, as you hear, is Janine Gibson, the executive editor of Guardian.co.uk. More of a tweeter than an angler.
Okay.
Now, over the past few months, we've discussed the online plans of Rupert Murdoch. This week, the Australian media mogul made his intentions clear, well, a bit clearer than before. Speaking as News Corp announced a $2 billion net loss for the first half of the financial year, Murdoch declared that the ad-funded business model for online news is over and said that his stable of titles would take the lead in the switch over to paid-for content. He singled out the Telegraph scoop on MPs' expenses as a prime example of news for which people would be willing to pay for. So a line in the sand has been drawn. Or has it? Janine, is this a case of let battle commence, or we're all behind you?
I think there's something really interesting, which James picked up on in his piece of the paper, which is, why is Rupert Murdoch making such a big deal of signalling his intentions to the entire industry? Never in the history of Rupert Murdoch has he spent months alerting us all to the fact that in a bit I'm going to do this quite enormous strategic move. So you've got to ask yourself, why is he doing that? And clearly why he's doing that is he'd quite like everybody to go with him, thank you very much, because nobody wants to be the first behind a paywall leaving all the other free content out there. He's sort of very heavily hinted that there would be paid for news websites by the end of this year. He's now saying definitely by the end of the financial year. I'm assuming what he's saying is to the rest of the industry, don't worry, I'm going, and you can all come with me and it will be lovely, because even Rupert Murdoch's terrified of leaving a load of free alternatives out there.
Is it likely, James, that other people will fall in behind him, or are his rivals just likely to sit back and see what happens?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, if Murdoch can crack it, I suspect there'll be many, the independent springs to mind, who'll just rip off his model or do the best they can and pile in behind him. I'm not sure what our own strategy is, if Emily was here. maybe she can tell us, Janine. I think what is interesting is, though, of course, is that one organisation that won't be following him down that road is obviously the BBC.
Yeah.
So
I mean, this is the elephant. Well, there's lots of elephants in this room.
Yes, lots of elephants, but
that's one of them. And so it's certainly an elephant in the British room, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we would think that would concentrate the minds of legislators and lawmakers, wouldn't you? I mean, it's into the whole Murdoch versus the BBC thing there, right? You know, if I'm going to have to put, if my papers are losing so much money or making less money than they were, yet the BBC is free. I mean. That's an interesting angle in all this.
Yeah, all right. Well, we can come to that in a minute. But back to the idea of his rivals, Janine. Do you think it makes it more likely, you know, his announcements and his re-announcements of this make it more likely that people will fall in behind him, or just do you think that people will wait and see what happens and see what he does? Because it could be a win-win situation for his rivals.
Well, it depends. It depends which rival you're talking about. Yeah. I think if you're independent, you're kind of in a very different position to where you are if you're the Guardian. And similarly, as James quite rightly points out, the BBC is the great big market intervention. I don't think, for example, the brutal paywall is something that anybody particularly likes as a solution. I think we all think, you know, I think it was Vivian Chell today was saying, you know, there are many different flavours of paywall and there are all sorts of different ways you can cut it.
Yeah, she's the chief executive of NPR and she used to run the New York Times. I think she pulled down the paywall.
Around Time Select, absolutely. Yeah. And quite rightly, she's sort of saying, you know, there's all sorts of different ways you can cut it. I very much doubt that we're looking at, I think I've said this before, that you're looking at a situation where it's just going going to put up a brick wall. A brick wall.
It's far too
because,
crude.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody's talking about that anymore. But then from that position, everybody, even the ones who are, like, we would probably be right on the spectrum of free, free, free to everybody. We're giving out all our content to everyone. But everybody's looking at different ways in which you can charge for different things. And can you cut it in different ways? Other bits of functionality? In what way can you monetize your content that isn't necessarily building a big wall in front of it?
Well, you know, there are all sorts of things like, you know, you can charge for specific small parts or for events or for iPhone apps, or, you know, there's all sorts of things that you can think about before saying it's £10 for everything.
Well, this is the maturing of an industry, isn't it, essentially, is people suddenly realizing that it's just not this very black or white subscription model or not. I think the other thing that everybody pretty much agrees on is that the ways in which people pay have got to be incredibly easy and barely touch the sides and not feel like payment and certainly not feel like you're getting your credit card out to pay to read that article.
But this is the problem, in that there isn't an iTunes for newspapers at the moment, James.
No, there isn't, but and it would that there were. But, I mean, there are. I mean, if you create premium content using... I mean, there are lots of things you could do if you think about the big commentators that people read. I think the New York Times put their big stars behind a paywall, didn't they? And that wasn't a good idea.
That was a total disaster, because, and that led to the Huffington Post.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that a similar experiment won't work. But it's about creating content that you can't get on the website of the paper proper, isn't it? Mm.
It's very difficult, Janine, isn't it, to now that we've had 15 years of conditioning the audience to think that there's no value in news or even comment and analysis online, to recondition people and putting a very big genie back into...
Why do you say 15 years?
No, isn't that the age of the internet?
In a slightly ranty thing yesterday, which the great irony of all this is Rupert Murdoch preaching in his sort of, you know, telephone call to media correspondents about the value and the cost of quality content, and people need to realise that there is a value and a cost of quality content. Who's been giving away their newspapers for 5p to try and undercut the market for the last 20 bloody years? It's Rupert Murdoch. The idea that actually you should get this thing for free because we're going to rook the advertisers to pay for it is almost entirely...
Predates the internet.
Down to him and his group, and this idea that we'll just go for the mass eyeballs and the mass audience, and then we'll worry about, you know, where to get the profits from the advertising.
That's the thing, that the advertising is dried up, and there's no way you can describe Rupert Murdoch as some sort of visionary. I mean, it's actually more of a panicky defensive move.
He bought MySpace for $600.
Yeah, I mean, and look how that worked out.
And yet, let's not get too sneery, because he still has enough force in the market to provide a great big turn in the road. And I think what's really interesting, and what we slightly forget, because we're a little bit newspaper obsessed, I can't think why, is the video that he controls. And
this is where
you can copyright video, you can have stuff in video that isn't necessarily this sort of commoditized news. You know, shots of Jordan romping with God knows who in the Ibiza villa.
I think he's a cage fighter, isn't he?
Actually, I'm pretending I don't know the details.
He's a cage fighting hunk, I'm being told.
Used to be in Hollyoaks.
Alex Reed.
Anyway, that story that we barely paid any attention to. The details of that, you can put behind a paywall. You can put the video of Amy Winehouse snorting malarkey or Max Mosley being whipped. You can put that behind a paywall.
Or you can imagine a scenario where, you know, Sky Sports has got Premiership football rights, but you might see the goals on the Sun. I don't know. Once you start thinking about this.
I don't know about the rights thing, because that gets very, very complicated. But certainly when he was talking about the value of a celebrity scoop, what you then have to think about is, what he's not talking about is, I hope, the value of the knowledge that Jennifer Aniston is pregnant. You can't protect that. That's gone.
No,
but the pictures of Jennifer talking, moving, it is the OK model.
With Jennifer.
And that you can copyright and that you can sue over.
But I thought, hang on a second. I thought we were talking about upholding quality journalism. Rupert Murdoch was saying that it was quality journalism that
you don't think that is quality journalism?
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
It's better than any story I've ever broken.
He's
Jennifer Aniston being pregnant?
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah.
He is setting himself up as the sort of moral on the moral high ground on the hill of quality journalism, isn't he? But that's what he's trying to do. He's saying quality journalism needs to be funded and people need to pay for it.
He's never set himself up as the bastion of quality journalism. He's set himself up as somebody who can flog newspapers and get people to tune into television stations and pay for them. Hmm. He's never declared himself to be a bastion of quality journalism.
No, I've just except
when he's trying to buy the Wall Street Journal.
Yes, that's right. And
didn't he just say, look, I'm going to pay? And the family mithered a bit about quality journalism and then back down, took the money and ran. Good decision.
Well, this, as you can imagine, has been causing a lot of controversy on the blogs. Here's just a couple of your comments. Zands said, eventually all old tyrants condemn themselves to death. What kind of mug would pay for something on the internet these days? Fee Bell said, Fox News has the worst website in the industry, so no big deal. Murdoch will only lose money and audience. His loss.
Sorry, there is one other thing that we haven't mentioned that is quite important. What? You're getting annoyed.
No, it's just funny. And, you know, Janina pointing and fingering. And another thing. Go on.
It's probably not got anything to do with making a serious subscription model out of the internet at the moment. It's just about not putting content for free online and wringing the last bit of value out of the newspapers.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
Well, that all leads us onto a story rather close to home. The Guardian Media Group is reported to be considering the future of its Sunday newspaper, The Observer, as it conducts a review of its publishing strategy across print and online. Closure is believed to be one of the options on the table, as is turning The Observer into a weekly news magazine or retaining it as a newspaper, but in a slimmed-down format. The reason? The same thinking that lies behind Rupert Murdoch's decision to start charging for content. So, what does the future hold for the oldest Sunday paper in the world? Are Sunday papers relevant of a pre-digital print industry? I spoke to a professor of journalism and Media Guardian press commentator, Roy Greenslate.
Well, it's quite obvious that with the Guardian Media Group having lost so much money in 1 year, that there must be discussions going on all over the company about how they can save money, cut costs, as indeed has happened to every single media company in Britain in the past year. They are bound to throw every ball in the air and see where it lands in such circumstances. They must be thinking about how they can save an immense amount of money, and there must have been discussions which said, let's imagine the worst. Would we even think of closing a famous title like The Observer? Whether or not that has reached any other stage than beyond discussions is unclear. But it is obvious that if the chief executive issues a statement in which he fails to deny that The Observer is for sale, then it does at least give rise to speculation and is the reason that the headlines have occurred this week.
Now, some of our commenters on the website have been suggesting that the Observer and indeed the GMG regional papers, which have also suffered swingeing cuts, that they're being sacrificed at the altar of the Guardian's, you know, unproven digital ambitions. What would your analysis of that be?
Well, I think that the Guardian have taken massive steps towards an unknown future. I don't think anyone can be absolutely certain, but it appears to me, and of course I'm well recognised as somebody who is a bit of a digital revolutionary, if that's the right phrase, I do think that we are changing from print to screen, and those who invest most heavily in it and who gain all the know-how from doing that are those who are likely to last into the future. I think it's a bit unfair for people to suggest that because The Guardian has taken this route, and therefore, in their view, imperiled the rest, it somehow is bad for The Guardian to have done so. But the truth is, if you look at what's happened in other media companies, they are in the same sort of peril without having made similar investments. So I don't think that there's a correlation between the two.
I mean, broadening it out a bit, how different is the newspaper, i.e. the print newspaper market, going to look in, say, 10 years' time? It may be that The Observer doesn't exist. It may be that other titles don't exist, do you think?
Well, I think the axe hangs over several titles. They show an amazing determination to cling on, publishers and editors, as you might expect, because, as I previously said, we are entering the unknown. But I do imagine that there will be fewer print titles around in the next decade on the national newspaper scene. And I would have thought that there are other publishers who believe that it's necessary to take very difficult, radical decisions in order to save the hub of a company. The hub of Guardian Media Group, without any doubt, is the Guardian itself, and it has to be protected at all costs. That is the injunction, not of various executives, but of the Scott Trust, who is the ultimate owner of the Guardian.
And what about the Sunday newspaper market in general? I mean, are we falling out of love with Sunday newspapers? The Sunday Times seems to be going as strong as ever.
It's undoubtedly the case that the greatest success story of the past 20 years for serious newspapers and popular newspapers has been Saturday editions. And the weekend starts there, and the Saturday editions are bumper editions. They sell incredibly well, and that has put the squeeze on the Sundays. And I think that's a terrific problem for them. Of course, the other problem for the Sunday market would be that if there were titles to go, if The Observer did go, let's imagine that it went, the axe certainly swings heavily over The Independent on Sunday. It would change the political complexity of serious newspapers on a Sunday, and I'm sure that would be worrying for those of us on the liberal left who feel that there would be no voice, no proper voice, no proper serious voice on a Sunday.
Roy Greenslade there. Janine, can you give us any inside track from the the upper echelons of The Guardian?
No.
Okay. James.
Yes.
You're an Observer man, you know.
One wrong move and my career could be over. I feel like one of those sort of expats who sort of move to another country. I'm not comfortable in my new country, then go home and I don't really fit in there either, you know. what do you want to know? Well, tell me what you want to know and I'll tell you.
It'd be a sad day to see the end of The Observer.
It would be a sad day to see the end of The Observer. I do question whether, I mean, I don't know if they've looked at a sale or not, but I mean, and even if there were buyers, I'd wonder if we'd really want to sell to a competitor. I mean, would you want to sell The Observer to, say, there was some Indian guy with 50 million quid who was seeking political influence? Here you go, 50 million quid, Scott Trust. I'm going to take The Observer and put loads of resources into it. No, I don't think that's what... It's not an ideal outcome, is it, really, if you look at it in commercial terms? But, yeah, I mean, we've got... I don't really understand the idea of a Guardian on Sunday when we've already got a Sunday newspaper that's called The Observer.
Mm.
But then, you know, of course, I am nowhere near as intelligent or talented as the executives who run this company, so I'm sure they've got all the answers.
Far be it from us. Roy Greenslade's point about the political complexion of Sunday newspapers is interesting, because it does seem that those on the right of the spectrum, you know, are more likely to survive, and you could get a sort of rebalancing of where the papers are on Sundays, Janine. And should we be worried about that?
There's so many premises in that question that I don't quite know how to unpick it, because you're starting from the premise.
You're criticising my question.
Yeah, I am. I'm going to pull it apart mercilessly so as not to answer it. It suggests that, for a start, The Observer is going to close, which I think the one thing that we're absolutely clear on is no decision has been made on that, even if we don't know what the thinking is. Then it presupposes that The Independent on Sunday will also close, and it presupposes that through both of those things, the loss-making Sunday Times and the, I don't know what the situation for the Sunday Telegraph is, but I'd be fairly certain it's pretty close to loss-making as well, are somehow going to survive in a triumphal way because of their right-wing political perspective. So I don't think I think any of those things are particularly, I'm afraid, relevant.
Okay.
Or necessarily true.
I think could go over there and you could ask questions if you like. We could do it that way around.
But I also think... there's something very strange about... I know what Roy means, but I think there's something very strange about mourning the fact that the market won't provide... You know, either there is an appetite for such a thing, or there isn't. Mm-hmm. And if we are in a situation where only right-wing newspapers are available on a Sunday, well, then I'm sure somebody will start a newspaper. If there's a market for it, somebody will start one that will be... Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of wrong. Also, there's the Sunday Mirror. That is, in fact, you know... Quite
and the people?
And the people still making money. As every 3 months on Media Talk, we go, no, the people still makes money.
Yeah, right. Now, listen, I was going to say, you know, you can keep up with this story on the Media Guardian website, but probably not the first place to look for developments on this one. But you can stay up with all the rest of the latest media news on mediaguardian.co.uk. Okay, before we look at what else is going on in media land, I have an announcement. If you're in Edinburgh in the last week of August and you're at a loose end, why not come and join the audience when we record Media Talk live at the Edinburgh TV Festival? It's at 10 a.m. on Sunday, August 30th at the Edinburgh International Conference Centre. Obviously, if you're at the TV Festival already, you can come anyway. But if you're not a delegate, you can get a special ticket for our session by emailing mediatalklive@guardian.co.uk. We'll have a top panel, including Emily Bell, and we'll be discussing the fallout from James Murdoch's McTaggart lecture. So if you're not a TV Festival delegate and you do want a ticket, email us at mediatalklive@guardian.co.uk. So to the rest of the news from the media week. And in the papers this week, Harriet Harman has been getting a real old kicking. And, you know, it's like, you know, have we wound back the clock to the mid-1970s?
But there was something about the Daily Mail's coverage of, you know, Harpy Harman and her ridiculous feminist manifesto and so on, which then combined with the TUC coming out with a story about wearing high heels to work and the
banning thereof.
The banning thereof. I did just start to think, what year is it? What's happened? Is it 1977 again? It was extraordinary. I know that the argument is that they're just taking on Harriet Harman because she's in charge and not because she's a woman. And I don't want to be oversensitive or anything, but...
But, I mean, well, it comes to something when, you know, there's an article in The Spectator by Rod Little that starts, "Would you do Harriet Harman?" I mean, that's what that is his premise. Yeah.
I did watch Mock the Week last night, just in case we think this is just the Daily Mail. Yeah. Mock the Week last night, which is not a programme I tend to watch a lot, contained about 5 solid minutes of people slagging off female politicians for not being very fit.
Yeah, it was just pure. So normally I do watch Mock the Week, and it is quite funny. But it was just, you know, 5 minutes of pure misogyny.
It was quite staggering, and I don't really know. If the Mail is to be believed, the BBC is so self-policing with its PC gone mad attitude that there's no way that would have got through. So what is it about Harriet Harman that makes it okay?
Okay, we'll see what happens when you know, Gordon Brown gets back next week. Thank you, Janine. At this point, we should say that that we're going to wave goodbye to you because, you know...
Because you don't want to torment me with any more comments about what the Guardian Media Group might be up to.
No, and I was going to make some sort of witty comment about top females in charge, but, you know, but I shan't.
I don't want any misogyny, frankly, about my shoes or my hairstyle. Both of which are quite crap. See you later.
No, you look fantastic. That is not a sexist comment.
Yeah, we can.
That's just an observation.
Thank you very much, Janine Gibson.
Bye.
And Janine's been ably replaced by the marvellous John Plunkett, the radio correspondent of MediaGuardian.co.uk. Hello.
Hi, Matt. My hair's looking lovely, and so are my shoes.
Yes.
I caught the tail end of the previous conversation.
Thank you very much. And, well, we've brought you in because we want to talk about the RAJAR figures, which are out this week. What were the interesting things there?
Well, on the top line, you think everyone was a winner. Most of the BBC main networks went up, and commercial radio share went up as well, mostly at the expense of BBC's local and regional stations, which seem to be on the slide for a couple of years now. The fly in the BBC ointment was Radio 2 losing share, not listeners, but losing share, which appears to be a trend, possibly from a peak of a couple of years ago under Leslie Douglas. And a couple of their digital stations, their most high-profile digital radio stations, which is BBC Six Music, and the archive channel BBC Seven, both lost listeners.
This is very interesting because this is the first time that there's been sort of evidence of a retreat from digital radio listening.
That's right. We should say, in fairness, they were up year on year, but they went down in double-digit percentage terms on the previous quarter. And with the expansion in listening on DAB, you'd expect those stations to at least hold their own, not go down.
So any signs of nervousness at the BBC because of that?
Well, I mean, they're not cheap, so you'd imagine that they cost £8, £9, £10 million each to run a year, so pretty soon they're going to have to start justifying their existence because they've been around for a few fair years now. And are there people on Six Music that we can't necessarily find slots for on Radio 2 or elsewhere on the BBC's main networks?
Okay, we'll leave that there, and we'll turn to the story about Mihir Bose. He is, or was, the BBC's sports editor, brought in a quite high profile move from the Daily Telegraph couple of years ago, but James Robinson, he never really seen as a big success.
No, I don't think he was, to be fair. I think he had a bit of the Robert Pestons in the sense that not a natural broadcaster, I think it's fair to say. Peston got away with it and gets away with it partly because he brought in great stories.
Yeah.
I think Mihir's problem, and I met him and he's a very nice man and a very accomplished journalist, and I think the problem is sports stories aren't quite as big as the biggest business stories. There is no, you know, unless Man United get bought by Real Madrid or something. And I think he struggled for some profile on the BBC. But I think he left, well, apparently he left because he didn't want to move to Manchester, which is a problem that the BBC might have with other presenters, even those that, you know, star performers. But it's an extremely good hack.
The ITV's interim results make far from good reading. They've offloaded Friends Reunited, James, haven't they, to the Beano publishers, DC Thompson.
Yes. Which is the
sort of the top line. But the key fact here is it's a division of DC Thompson that owns genealogy websites. And I didn't realise this until this week, but Genes Reunited is the big value.
And that's what they wanted to get their hands on, yeah. Which is, we talked about Friends Reunited a bit on this show, haven't we? And it was clearly a disastrous investment. Although I was thinking I thought it wasn't as bad as I used to think it was when I heard finally heard the explanation for buying it, which is why not make a programme strand out of it? And why not do a similar thing to the BBC's Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah, but
it didn't sound so stupid. After all, apparently Charles Allen was, you know, that idea was vetoed by his programme makers. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Internet sites are fads. They are fads, aren't they? That's the thing. Even MySpace now looks like a bit of a fad.
Well, I went on Friends Reunited today in tribute to its big money sale, and it just strikes you as still looks very old-fashioned. It's very clunky. I got told that I visited 0% of the world's countries, which I didn't necessarily want to hear first thing on a Friday. But I did get an email from a chap. I went to inevitably a Genesis concert at Wembley Stadium in 1987, where the support was Paul Young, and I didn't really want to hear from him either, but I pretty well dropped him a line.
What's he doing now?
I didn't say.
The only thing that I thought was actually they were quite lucky to get $25 million for it. I mean, that's, you know...
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? Yeah. It only made a loss of $100 million in 3 years.
Well done, ITV. Let's switch channel from ITV to Channel 4, and indeed from More 4 News to No More News. Sad news for Channel 4 News. Well, I mean, you know, I've always said I've never seen the point of More 4 News.
Certainly since they launched Channel 4 Plus One, which meant you could watch Channel 4 News at the same time that More 4 News was on. I actually quite like More 4 News, but I think some nights it had an audience of 30,000 odd. So,
and it's not really sustainable. Quite interesting, and a surprise, I guess, that they axed the lunchtime bulletin on Channel 4 as well.
Yes, I think I'll miss the midday bulletin more than I'll miss More 4 News. Yeah, especially since a personal bugbear of mine, which was in Radio 5 Live, axed their midday half-hour bulletin.
Oh, yeah.
So clearly there are these things called 24-hour news channels, but I quite like the idea of a succinct wrap-up at midday.
Hmm.
So one more bites the dust.
Poor Krishna Guruma, I think he'll have to go back to playing second fiddle to Jon Snow. Now, viewers in Scotland will have their own programmes. That was a familiar line in the 80s, but it's appropriate now because the Channel 3 franchise holder in Scotland has ditched The Bill, Midsummer Murders, and several other high-profile shows made south of the border, including Monday Monday, actually, which is a disaster. I would have thought if you were a Scottish viewer, you'd be clamouring for that. It's part of a long-running dispute between ITV PLC, which now runs all the Channel 3 franchises in England and Wales, and the remnants of the original ITV regional system. Now, Robert Beveridge is a lecturer in media policy at Edinburgh Napier University. He told me why STV is pursuing this course.
It's decided to do this because it's becoming more Scottish. It's living up to its name, which after all is Scottish television, and it's meeting the needs of viewers and listeners in Scotland by so doing.
The motivation isn't entirely altruistic, though, isn't it? Is it? There's a business and commercial mind behind all of this as well.
Well, absolutely, because Rob Woodward and his team have taken over a company which really was very close to bankruptcy and developed a new strategy for programming, and that seems to be successful so far. Beyond this, however, they're positioning themselves both as a commercial company and as possibly a public service broadcaster in the future, should ITV decide to give up its public service broadcasting status post-digital switchover.
There's an interesting scenario here, which is that, well, a few months ago, the Scottish Broadcasting Commission, which looked into all of this in Scotland, recommended that a publicly funded digital network should be set up in Scotland with about £35 million of public money. Does STV think that some of that money might come its way?
There seems to be no doubt that part of the strategy is positioning themselves for that eventuality. But beyond that, the viewing figures seem to indicate that viewers in Scotland like having more Scottish content produced in Scotland by Scottish broadcasters. And the Scottish Broadcasting Commission report under Blair Jenkins produced evidence which demonstrated that. And so what STV are doing is following the evidence.
So what do you think would be the response of ITV nationally to what its partner in Scotland is now doing?
Yes, ITV could go straight to market in Scotland, and indeed there seem to be some indications that they might wish to do that.
So they could launch ITV in Scotland separately. Absolutely. To STV. Yeah,
and right. Were that to happen, then obviously STV would become little more than a small production company making programmes that it would be able to sell whatever it wished. And indeed the current concern about the future of Taggart, should ITV in England choose not to recommission it, does demonstrate that that's a very real danger and possibility.
So there could be a political battle looming then between Edinburgh and London, because presumably if ITV did decide to do that there would be political consequences.
Absolutely, and I think depending upon which governments of which political persuasions were in power in Edinburgh and London, that would become what we call in Scotland rather a stooshy. But having said that, I myself don't believe that it's in ITV's commercial interest, whether it stays as a PSB or not, to get rid of Taggart, because Taggart does perform rather well in the schedules.
Well, there could be another murder for Taggart to investigate. What at the end of the day, is there any sign that viewers in Scotland have really noticed that they're missing out on such delights as The Bill and Monday? I think they're missing.
Yes, I think there's some discussion, particularly in some of the tabloid press around this, but of course they've got their own axe to grind as well. What is generally the case is that, and this affects both STV, / ITV and the BBC, BBC Scotland and the BBC UK, is that viewers in Scotland feel that they don't get enough programmes which are made reflecting their culture and identity, and they would the evidence is consistent that they would like to see more of that.
But what has STV been filling the schedules with? It's been old films and South Park, hasn't it?
Yes, but the old films, of course, have included gems such as David Putnam's Local Hero and so on. And there's a reservoir of affection for, and Whiskey Galore, there's a reservoir of affection for those kinds of programmes. It's just that we would like to see more modern programming. And indeed, at the moment, there are documentaries called Made in Scotland, which are being shown at a good time in the schedules, and they are getting good viewing figures.
OK, that's just about it from Media Talk for this week, but we can't let our panellists go by without discovering some gems from their diaries this week. John Plunkett, what have you been up to this week? What have you learned?
Well, the highlight, or possibly low light of my week, was on 9:30, BBC Two on Thursday evening, a new series called The Funny Side Off.
Which is always about, an inauspicious start.
It's a good start, isn't it? And it was hilarious. It really was. And essentially, it was a clip show with about talent shows with Clive Anderson in a studio behind a desk with no studio audience for no apparent reason. And in fact, I think it was a BBC Scotland production. But I just thought this is the recession writ large in my TV screen. It was it was a very depressing, formulaic cuts show, which I Love 1976 on primetime BBC Two. And I thought, crikey, I'm looking forward to the next five parts of this 6-part series.
It's come to something when Clive Anderson is doing
and with a Clive's career.
Well, yes. Well, he does loose ends, doesn't he, occasionally on a Sunday?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember Clive Anderson Talks Back.
That's right.
BGs, the tossers, isn't it?
Yes, it was.
Great days.
Yeah, magic of television. Magical television. James, what have you been up to this week?
Well, I last week I was in LA. I got back on Monday. Thanks. I'm feeling fairly jet lagged, but I was celeb spotting. So I bumped into Lindsay Lohan. That's quite good.
Yes,
that's A-list.
That's quite good. Yeah,
then
yeah.
The next on Sunday by the pool. On my final day, I was introduced to Rhino from Gladiators. He's a lovely guy called Mark who's trying to make it as an actor over there in Hollywood. And by all accounts, failing dismally.
Was he waiting tables in the meantime?
No, he wasn't. He was just pumping iron in the gym.
All right.
I walked past the gym. I didn't go in.
All right.
I've seen Rhino act, actually. Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah, in Panto in Rochester.
What was he playing?
He was good, actually. I forget. It was a long time ago, but he was a very nice chap.
Not one of the Seven Dwarves.
Wait,
Probably.
Was it Jack and the Beanstalk?
I was going to say, it was probably Pip playing the back end of a rhino.
Yeah, probably both ends.
Yes, possibly. Anyway, how astonishing that you should meet Rhino and you should have
another gladiator
a supplementary anecdote.
Well, yeah, Wolf, of course, the other gladiator. He once turned out for, again in Medway in North Kent, he turned out for the, he wanted to be a footballer, professional footballer, and he turned out for the Gillingham Second Eleven. apparently he didn't have a lot of puff, but his bargain was the worst in his bite. But they got a big turnout. They got a bigger crowd for that reserve match. Are you still with me than they do for their they used to get for their, for their first 11 games?
Excellent. Well, I mean, this is just media talk gold.
No more gladiator stories.
No,
sorry, they could do a gladiators 11, couldn't they? All star 11 football team. Maybe some charity event. I don't know. Sorry, I'm jet lagged, as I said. I'm tired.
On which note, thank you very much to James Robinson, as John Plunkett, to give your feedback. If you've met a gladiator, yes, on anything you've heard, do post a comment on our blog, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, or find us on Facebook or on Twitter if they're working and not downed by some crazy Russians who are trying to unleash the force of their might on the internet. Mediatalk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. See you next time.